Joshua, chapters 1 and 2, the first talk in a series on the narrative portions of Joshua, was presented by David Crabtree on October 9, 2005, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to start in on the book of Joshua today. We'll look at Joshua 1 and 2. I'm planning to work through the narrative portions of Joshua over the next there's a break in the middle of it, but I'll be teaching for about 6 weeks. And I think I'll get through most of the narrative portion of Joshua in that period of time. I'm going to take it in pretty big chunks. Joshua talks about the conquest of Canaan. I will do this very briefly, but let me rehearse the events that precede this. Long before the events that are described in the book of Joshua, which the date is we'll just say the 1300s BC, that it depends on how exactly you reconstruct the chronology. But the events that precede this, that are important and relevant to this, happened much earlier in the 1900s BC. God gave to Abraham the land of Canaan. He promised it to Abraham's descendants. Abraham lived out his life in Canaan, in Palestine. He lived his life out there in that land. He died and was buried there, but it was never really his land. He didn't really possess it. His grandson and great-grandsons left Canaan and went down to Egypt, and where they became very numerous and became enslaved to the Egyptians over a period of about 400 years. At the end of 400 years, they were very numerous, and at that time, God instructed Moses to lead them out of slavery in Egypt and to go to the Promised Land. So with many signs and wonders, God took them out of Egypt and took them through the desert that separates Egypt from Palestine, during which time the Israelites were whiners and complainers and disobedient. But God took care of their needs and helped them make their way through the desert. In addition, he provided them with the law in which he instructed them in the way that he wanted them to conduct themselves. They made their way to the southern end of Canaan. God told them to go in and take the land, and they were frightened by the prospect of going in against formidable cities and armies and would not go in. As a result, God said, I would like you to spend about 40 years in the desert more to think about it, and during which time all of the older generation died off except for two, Joshua and Caleb. Now, Joshua had become an assistant of Moses during the original trek across the wilderness. In fact, Joshua went up part of the way on Mount Sinai when Moses went up to receive the law. Joshua also was prominent later on when, just before they were supposed to go into the land, spies were sent in to look at the land and figure out how they would go about conquering the land. Joshua was one of the ones who went in. And he and Caleb were the only two that came back without any discouraging presentations of what the land was like, that they saw that things were formidable, but they said, nevertheless, we should go in as God has instructed. So they were the two of the ones of the scouts who went in that were not discouraging. After 40 years then wandering around in the wilderness, then God begins to move them up the east side of Canaan into position to go into the promised land finally. They defeat two of their opponents on the east side of the Jordan, and then they move into the plain that's just opposite, just across the Jordan River from Jericho. And that's the plain where they land and camp for a period of time. While they're camped there, Moses gives them a final speech in which he repeats the law that was given to him at Mount Sinai, and he warns them against being disobedient or rebellious against their God. Then after giving the speech, and that's the speech that we have in Deuteronomy, after that speech, Moses dies, just as God had said that Moses would not be allowed to go into the promised land. Moses dies before they go across the Jordan River. And just before he dies, he passes authority on to Joshua. So Joshua then is the leader of Israel, and he's the one who will take them into the land. So that's where the events leave off when we enter into the book of Joshua. And that's where we'll pick up in chapter 1. Now it came about after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' servant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, cross this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving to them, to the sons of Israel. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads, I have given it to you, just as I spoke to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, even as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and as far as the great sea toward the setting of the sun will be your territory. No man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may have success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. First he refers to Moses and refers to him as my servant. That's quite a compliment. There aren't many times when God refers to a man, an individual, as his servant. There are only a handful of people in the Old Testament that are so called. So this is quite a compliment. Joshua, I'll point out, is not referred to as my servant by God until the last chapter of the book of Joshua. I guess you have to wait and see how a man's life turns out before it's appropriate to use that designation. He gives him his first assignment, and the first assignment is to cross the Jordan River. That's not a small assignment. The Jordan's a fairly large river, and as we'll find out in chapter 3, it was apparently at flood stage at the time that they were going to cross it. Not only is the river a large river, but we've got steep banks that are going down. We have a rapid descent of a couple thousand feet over a fairly short distance. You have to go down to get down to the bottom of the valley where the river is located. And then on the other side, it's not quite as far up, but it's also a steep bank on the other side, steep, long bank. And we have a large number of people that we're going to move down this one bank, across the river, and up the other bank. So this is the first step in a long expedition, but this first step is a doozy. Then he describes the land that they are to take possession of, and that's Canaan. It's one of the, this particular description lays out the boundaries that are at their largest. Sometimes the land is described a little differently and it is not quite as expansive, but this is a particularly expansive description. Then he makes a promise. He's going to make a promise to Joshua, and then he gives him some injunctions. The promise is, no man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. That's a huge promise. Joshua had been alongside Moses through at least most of the trip across from Egypt. So Joshua was in a position to see what was happening from the perspective of an insider. So he knew what was going on. And he was able to observe Moses close up. And what God is saying is, I will stand by you just like I stood by Moses. And that's quite a promise. And on the basis of that, he says, I will not fail you or forsake you. So that's a huge promise that he can take great comfort in. Then he enjoins Joshua to do something. And the rest of this section that I read, I think, is all that same injunction. Because it starts out with, in verse 6, be strong and courageous. And then it's going to repeat that in verse 9. So I think all that comes in between here is part of that injunction, be strong and courageous. I don't have the rest of this in my notes, so it's going to be freelance. The first thing, the strong and courageous, what he's going to do is a difficult thing to do. He's being asked to conquer this land, and there are going to be a lot of obstacles along the way. And the thing that's going to be necessary in order for him to accomplish this is he's going to have to stick to the course. No matter how discouraging it may get, he has to stay the course to keep the faith. And the basis for that faith is going to be his trust in the God who told him to do it. That's what it's all going to hinge on. Is this God who told him to do it and who is guaranteeing his success, is this God trustworthy? Will he see Joshua through it? He goes on to say, do all according to my word. So the first part of it is he's telling Joshua to act according to the law. He wants him to be obedient to the law. And I think there are two parts to that. I think there are two reasons why he's asking him to do that. The first is, that's all part of what it means to be obedient to God. That going in and taking the promised land, God has told him to do that. That's his bigger chore. But he needs to do that within certain parameters. And those parameters include obeying the law. He's supposed to do that in a way that is obedient to the law. If he acts in obedience to God, if he does acts in obedience with, in, he acts according to the law, there is something about that process that is actually faith building. Let me see if I can describe the steps in that. Whenever we are trying to be obedient to God, as we're living our lives, there are all kinds of situations that we come into that it is difficult to know what God wants us to do. And it is a soul-searching process to try to sort that out and figure out, well, what would God like me to do in this particular circumstance? One of the strongest pulls on us, whenever we're in that process, at least this is what I experience all the time, is what is driving me? As I'm trying to sort this out, what is steering my thinking towards one option as opposed to another option? And I am very aware that one of the things that always steers me is what I want. And I have to be conscious of that as I'm working through my decision process. I have to keep asking myself, what do I want more, what I want, or what God wants? What do I want more? Do I want that which appears to be attractive to me, or do I want that which God says is the right thing to do? So every decision is, in a sense, a soul-searching decision, trying to sort out that issue. Do I want what I want, or do I want what God wants? And as I pursue what God wants, and I forego those things that looked attractive to me, my experience has been, and my experience shows, that God knows better. In retrospect, looking back, the times that I have foregone the things that I wanted and diligently sought to do what I thought God wanted me to do, it has turned out, not always, but it has turned out clearly well in a number of instances, such that I can look back at my history and say, God has done a good job of taking care of me. In fact, God has done a better job of taking care of me than could I. He's smarter than I am. One of the problems that I have in making decisions is I know so little. I don't know what's coming up. I don't know what the future holds. There are so many unanswered questions. There's so much information I don't have at my fingertips that I need to make a good decision. When it comes down to it, I'm incapable. And I've come to realize that. And I've come to realize that God knows better. And, in addition to that, He really does care about me, such that He's been able to steer me through some very difficult circumstances incredibly well. And I am very grateful to Him. So, setting out to live your life according to the law is faith-producing. It makes it possible to stand and be courageous because God has proven Himself to be faithful to me so often in so many circumstances. So that's one reason that he's supposed to live according to the Word. Now there's another one, but I can't remember what it is, and I can't find that page of notes. Oh, no, the other part is The other part is that it's a part of being obedient. You need to know the law. Doing what he was asked to do according to the law is part of being completely obedient to what God had asked him to do. Okay, then he's supposed to meditate on it. Well, you can't do the law unless you know what it is. So it's a matter of meditating on the law, studying it, taking it seriously. There are several reasons why meditating on the law is important. The first is we are so forgetful. As I get older, I get more forgetful, but even apart from that, we're all forgetful. It is astounding how clear certain principles and values can be in my mind when I'm studying a piece of scripture. And how quickly that fades the next day when I'm out in the middle of the affairs of life. And I wouldn't say it's so much that I forget completely. It's just that they kind of lose their clarity. They just aren't right there at the surface anymore. They've kind of fallen back into the background a little bit. And there's something about studying the law, that's what Joshua was enjoined to do. There's something about studying the law that brings those back into clarity again, once again in stark relief to the values that we would otherwise drift towards. The illustration that always comes to my mind, and it's like so many illustrations that always come to my mind, they are always things that I know nothing about. But they make great illustrations. I think of returning to the law and looking at it again, it's like the chiropractic of the soul. It's like going in and getting everything realigned again, because somehow, in the busyness of life, everything gets out of kilter. Everything's out of alignment. And it's going, returning to the law and looking at it, studying it carefully, thinking about it, meditating on it, that's that kind of chiropractic that gets everything back in line the way it ought to be. And it has to be done time after time after time. Because life is the kind of thing that always gets us out of alignment. Second reason that it's important for us to be meditating on the law. Life gets more complex as we get older. I have often remarked how smart I used to be. I used to be so smart because the world used to be so simple. It was so clear. Everything fit. Everything was easy. Everything was black and white. As I get older, the colors kind of smudge. And the world gets far more complex. The answers that used to work so easily no longer work anymore. Everything has to be refined. Everything has to be made more nuanced. And that's a constant process because as I live life, the world keeps getting complexer. And the answers need to get more nuanced. They have to be more precise. They have to be more carefully thought through. So I'm convinced that there is no end in this life to our need to return to the law and look at it once again. Because as our life keeps getting more complex, as we learn more, as we experience more, we have to go back and get clearer, better, more precise answers. And the other reason to keep going back to the law is the importance of clarifying in our mind what God values, such that we can make what He values what we value. As we study the law, we aren't just learning rules. We're really getting a picture of who God is in the sense of what God thinks is important, what He values. And that's at the heart of who God is. And we need to adopt that as our own. So the study of the law is a study of God. We're really penetrating to the center of what makes God tick, what's important to Him. So Joshua has been told to stand, to be strong and to be courageous. And tied to that, do all according to the law. And tied to that is to meditate on it. And not to let it leave your mouth. Don't let it depart from your consciousness. All of those things then are tied together to the injunction to be strong and to be courageous. Oh, there's one. Let me point out one other thing. One of the things that I find so helpful about studying the Bible is, and I'm mixed. God was talking about the law. I'm extending this to include more of the Old Testament and the New Testament. I think the principle is the same. I find it so refreshing to have repeated to me God's values because there is something really noble about what God asks us to do and how God asks us to live our lives. And it is refreshing and I think revitalizing to be reminded of those things and to be reminded of how high-minded and noble a purpose that we are called to, the standards that we are called to. I'm convinced that there is something built into every one of us that resonates with the truths of God and what He is asking us to do, how He was asking us to live our lives. That there's something really noble, and we sense that it's noble, about being faithful, about being honest, about being loving, about being caring, etc., etc. There's something that really resonates inside of us when we meditate on those things. So it's revitalizing. And he says, then he summarizes it, be strong and courageous, do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go, repeating his promise that he'd given at the beginning. Next section, Then Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, "Pass through the midst of the camp, and command the people, saying, 'Prepare provisions for yourselves. For within 3 days you are to cross this Jordan, to go in to possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess it.' And to the Reubenites, and to the Gadites, and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, Joshua said, 'Remember the word which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, saying, "The Lord your God gives you rest, and will give you this land. Your wives, your little ones, and your cattle shall remain in the land which Moses gave you beyond the Jordan. But you shall cross before your brothers in battle array, all your valiant warriors, and shall help them, until the Lord gives your brothers rest as he gives you, and they also possess the land which the Lord your God is giving them. Then you shall return to your own land and possess that which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you beyond the Jordan toward the sunrise.' And they answered Joshua, saying, 'All that you have commanded us we will do, and wherever you send us we will go. Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, so we will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you, as he was with Moses. Anyone who rebels against your command and does not obey your words and all that you command him shall be put to death. Only be strong and courageous.'" Now the background to this is, if you'll recall from the book of Numbers, that there were two tribes and a half tribe. I guess that's two and a half tribes. There were two tribes that wanted to stay on the east side. They looked at the pasture lands that were there. They had some flocks and some herds. And they said, "You know, this is great. We really like this. I mean, it's so much better than the Sinai. We really like this. We're content to stay here." And they asked Moses if they could stay there. And if you will recall, Moses' response was, "You are doing, at this point in time, the very thing that the spies who were sent into the land 40 years ago and came back with a discouraging report, you're doing the same thing that they did 40 years ago, because you are taking the heart out of the people of Israel. You're discouraging them." And their response was, "Well, we don't want to do that. We don't mean to do that." So the deal was made. Moses made a deal with them and said, "Well, if you are willing to go in and with the rest of Israel to take the land, then you can come back and have this." That was the arrangement that was made. So now Joshua is reminding them, "We're going in, and you said that you would go. Get your spears." And their response at this point of time is, "Absolutely, we'll do it." And when Joshua tells them to go, it's interesting. He says, "But you shall cross before your brothers in battle array." So he's asking them to take the lead in this. They won't be at the end of this parade. They're going to be at the very beginning of it. They're going to be the first ones to enter into it, to show their solidarity with the rest of the people of Israel. And they're willing to do that. They're willing to go in and play their part. So they're fulfilling the arrangement that they had made earlier. Furthermore, they say, "Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, we will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses." So they are reassuring Joshua, we will fully recognize your authority just as we did Moses. And in the study of history, you know that whenever there's a transfer of power, there's always that potential that there will be people who will not recognize the legitimacy of that transference. So here we've got Moses is dead, Joshua is taking his place, and when Joshua tells them it's time to go across the Jordan and into the Promised Land, that's the first test of his authority. And these tribes are saying, "We are fully behind you. We support you absolutely." And they go on to say, "Anyone who rebels against your command and does not obey your words in all that you command him shall be put to death." So they're firmly behind the legitimacy of his right to lead them. Then they say, "Only be strong and courageous. Sound familiar? That's what God had said to Joshua as well. So Joshua has been told by God to be strong and courageous, and now he has been told by his fellow Israelites to be strong and courageous. So the same injunction has been coming from God as well as his fellow Israelites. So he has a lot of support, which is a wonderful thing. He's got God on his side, and he's got his fellow Israelites firmly on his side and encouraging him to be strong and to stay the course as they proceed on this expedition. Chapter 2. Then Joshua, the son of Nun, sent two men as spies secretly from Shittim, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." So they went and came into the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab, and lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." And the king of Jericho sent word to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land." But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them, and she said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from." And it came about when it was time to shut the gate at dark that the men went out. "I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them." But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them in the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued them on the road to the Jordan, to the fords. And as soon as those who were pursuing them had gone out, they shut the gate. Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And when we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore, please swear to me by the Lord, since I have dealt kindly with you, that you will also deal kindly with my father's household and give me a pledge of faith, and spare my father and my mother and my brothers and my sisters with all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death." So the men said to her, "Our life for yours, if you do not tell this business of ours, and it shall come about when the Lord gives us the land that we will deal kindly and faithfully with you." So Joshua does what Moses had done for 40 years earlier. That is, they're about to go into the promised land. They're about to go out on this military campaign, and they send spies to investigate and figure out what their strategy ought to be. So he sends two spies. They go to Jericho, and apparently they go to Rahab, who is a prostitute, and apparently they do that because that's where you would get the least notice. They're doing something that they're going to a person that someone from out of the city would be likely to go to, I guess. So they go to Rahab, and she takes them into her house and takes them upstairs. And usually the roof of a house is like a living room. It's an extra living area, but it's also workspace. And she's got flax up there that's apparently drying, and so she has taken them up there and she hid them in the flax. Well, the king of Jericho has heard that there are not only strangers in the city, but there are men of Israel in the city. And Jericho seems to be on, what do they call it? What's New York on? Is it code red or level red or whatever? They're on high alert. And you can imagine the Israelites have been parked across the river for quite some time now. I don't know, it's been a couple of months probably, that they've been parked across the river. There's a large number of them. They had just recently defeated the two biggest kingdoms on the other side of the Jordan and defeated them handily. And now they're waiting here, and they know that they're coming to get Canaan. So Jericho's on high alert. So the king finds out that there are a couple of men of Israel that have come into Jericho, and he understands that they had paid a visit to Rahab. So he sends a messenger to Rahab to get information as to where they are. Rahab plays dumb. Rahab says, yeah, they were here. I didn't know where they were from. I don't know who they are, but they left. They left before it got dark. They left before the city gates would be closed. I don't know where they went, but I'm just sure if you go chasing after them right now, you'll catch up with them and you'll find them. Most of that was not true, and she knew it was not true. Instead, what she had done is hidden them upstairs. So she goes up to see them, and it's interesting what she says to them. Let me reread verses 9. I'll just read verses 9 through 11. And just pay attention to what she did know. I know that the Lord has given you the land. So she knows about the promise, and that's interesting. I don't know how much of the promise that she knows. I don't know how many of the details she knows about what God said to Abraham. And all the details. But at least she knows that Yahweh, the God of Israel, has given Canaan to the descendants of Abraham. She goes on, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. That is something that God said would happen. God had told the Israelites a couple of times in their voyage across the desert that he would send the dread of them upon the people of the land of Canaan. Then here's some details of what they've heard. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And when we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. So they all know about the parting of the Red Sea, and they also know about the victory that the Israelites had over the two Amorite kingdoms on the other side of the Jordan. She doesn't go into any other details. It would be fascinating to know what else they knew. What else did they know about the 40 years? And did they know why they were so long in the desert? Did they know about the disobedience of the Israelites that had occurred 40 years earlier? They could have, because there was an attempt that had occurred at making an incursion into Canaan at that time, and news of that could easily have made it to Jericho. So it's possible that there's much more that they knew here, and that they could kind of piece together what's going on, and they could piece together parts of a picture of who this God is that's leading these Israelites through the wilderness and into Canaan. In any case, she comes to an astounding conclusion. And that conclusion is that their God is the God of the universe. This isn't just any household God. This is the God. This is the Master. That's a remarkable recognition on her part. Most of the other people of Jericho are responding just in fear, but not really going behind it to see what's going on here and who is this God that's directing these people that are on their way to Canaan. So then she asks that a deal be made. She has understood that if these people are coming, if God is guaranteeing that they will take over the land, And if God is leading them to destroy their opponents, as he did Sihon and Og, then there's no hope for those who live in Canaan, other than if they appeal to the God of the Israelites. And that's what Rahab is doing here. She's saying, she's confident this is going to happen. The Israelites are going to take the land. And if that is the case, she's appealing to the sons of Israel and saying, please make a deal with me that you will save me and my household. So she has really cut her ties with her own culture and has allied herself with this other people for whom Yahweh is the God. And they agree to do so. Next section. Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall, so that she was living on the wall. And she said to them, go to the hill country, lest the pursuers happen upon you, and hide yourselves there for 3 days until the pursuers return. Then afterward you may go on your way. And the men said to her, we shall be free from this oath to you, which you have made us swear, unless when we come into the land you tie this cord of scarlet thread in the window through which you let us down, and gather to yourselves into the house your father and your mother and your brothers and all your father's household. And it shall come about that anyone who goes out of the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we shall be free. But anyone who is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head, if a hand is laid on him. But if you tell this business of ours, then we shall be free from the oath which you have made us swear. And she said, according to your words, so be it. So she sent them away, and they departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. Well, let me stop there and make just a few comments. Her apartment is apparently, her house is apparently part of the wall, and that was not uncommon. The wall around the city became the back wall for houses built right in front of it. And apparently there's some window in that wall from her house through which she's able to lower them down. And it's in that window then that they say, tie this scarlet thread so that we know which house to spare. And everyone that's in this army knows which house to spare. And so that's the agreement. Okay, the last section. And they departed and came to the hill country and remained there for 3 days until the pursuers returned. Now the pursuers had sought them all along the road, but had not found them. Then the two men returned and came down from the hill country and crossed over and came to Joshua the son of Nun. And they related to him all that had happened to them. And they said to Joshua, surely the Lord has given all the land into our hands, and all the inhabitants of the land, moreover, have melted away before us. So these spies do just as she had said. They go and they hide out for 3 days. And it's interesting that Rahab must have known the routine for doing searches. She knows that they go search for 3 days. So I suspect this has happened before, that there have recently been other searches that have been conducted. She knows how long it lasts. And so she's able to tell them, go hide out for 3 days, then the coast will be clear. That's exactly what happens. Once the coast is clear, then they make their way back across the Jordan, back to Joshua, and they report what has transpired. And their report is that the land has been given into our hands because all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before us. Morale is one of the most significant factors in any conflict. And the morale of the Canaanites has been undermined completely. They see the writing on the wall, and they are dispirited as a result of that. They're scared to death. And the Israelites realize that they'll be able to take advantage of that. There are a couple of things I'd like to comment on these two chapters. The first is the tension that Joshua is in, is a tension between, on the one hand, having this guarantee, God has guaranteed their success as they go in to take the land. That's a wonderful thing. But on the other hand, Joshua has to do it. It's guaranteed success, but the question is, how do we get from here to there? There are all these steps that have to be made. There are all these decisions that have to be made. There are all these frustrations that have to be faced into. They're going to come. They're going to happen. There will be times when it will be discouraging. There will be periods of time when it will just be frustrating. There will be periods of time when it doesn't look like it's going to happen. And they have to go through that. It's interesting that in the past, when I've read the story of the Exodus and things like this, my mind immediately assumed that they were receiving minute instructions as to what to do next. And as I've looked at it more carefully, I think there are indications, even in the Exodus, even when they're being led by the pillar of fire and the cloud, that they are having to make a lot of logistical decisions as they're proceeding through the desert. There are a lot of things that they have to decide on their own. It isn't all mapped out for them. And it's certainly true here. Joshua's leading them into Israel. It's not mapped out for them. God isn't giving them step-by-step instructions on what they're supposed to do. They've got to figure it out. There are difficult decisions to be made. And I'm sure that Joshua was thinking about this, and he realizes there are lives on the line. People are going to die here. And the decisions that I make will have an impact on who is killed and who is injured, and all of that will be on my conscience. And yet that's the task that's given to him. So he's going to take prudent steps, and that's what he does. He sends the spies in. I think that's interesting. He wants more information in order to make the best decision that he can. But in the midst of it, he is to be strong and courageous. Despite whatever setbacks there are or frustrations, it's just a matter of forging ahead. Ultimately, it's a done deal. That is analogous to our life in this world, that we also have a guarantee. We also have a promise that's been made to us by God, that as believers, God will one day make us whole and complete. The problem is from here to there. How do we do tomorrow? Or maybe even this afternoon? I mean, the problem is those steps that have to be made along the way, and those are agonizing. Those are very difficult. The outcome is not in doubt. The only question is, how do we act faithfully between here and there? There was last fall when I went back to the TRACS convention. It was for accreditation. And it had become clear to me that going before the commission was likely to be at least a little bit uncomfortable. And I was telling Susan just before I went in to meet with the commission, I said, I realize that the outcome of this is not a big issue in a sense, because it's in God's hands. And whatever their decision is fine. The problem is, nevertheless, I have to go through this ordeal. There's no way out of it. And there's so much of life that is like that. There are these things that we have to go through. There's no question about it. We just have to do it. The ultimate outcome is all guaranteed. But there's a lot of yuckiness that stands between it, us, and that we have to endure. We have to go through. And stay strong and courageous in the midst of it. The other thing I'd like to comment on is Rahab. What a fascinating character she is. We don't have a lot of information about her, but what an unlikely person. We've got, Jericho has tens of thousands of people in it. I don't know how many, but it's probably over 10,000 and it's probably under 50,000. But it's a big burg. And we only have evidence of one person responding the way that she does. And she happens to be a prostitute in the town. Not one that you would pick out as being a likely candidate. Not one that you would pick out as being spiritually aware. But God works in very strange ways in people's lives. And it is amazing to see him work in people's lives and amazing to see how he picks certain individuals out to bring them along to an understanding of who he is and through what circumstances he does that. And it's often very unlikely candidates. And the more likely candidates never quite come along. But God works in strange ways and picks people out. It's not dependent on social economic status. It's not education. It's not intelligence. It's none of those factors seem to be reliable indicators of whether someone will be responsive to the truth. It's just whoever God has selected to enter into their lives and make them aware and be concerned about the health of their soul. And he does that in remarkable ways. Okay, I'll stop there. Questions, comments?
I was wondering, when you said that some of the things about the spies must have been known, especially to Rahab, because they were going secretly into the land and they ended up staying at Rahab the harlot's house, it must have been, I would guess, somewhat uncharacteristic of them to do something like that, and that would have been a good place to hide. Or does that seem like maybe their motive for being there?
I think they go to Rahab because she is the person in town to whom it would be the most likely for some outsider to approach, to go to. I think that's why.
Okay. Yeah, I just was trying to figure that out a little bit. And then I have an unrelated question. Going back to the idea of meditating on the law, in a lot of Christian circles, as you know, there's a tendency to blur the distinction between law and gospel. Any practical approach to that you might want to put out so that, because I know in my own life I've at times blurred that distinction, and of course that's somewhat a painful process, and unraveling it of course is painful as well.
Well, I think in this particular context, I think what he's enjoining Joshua to do is to reflect on that which God had given to the people of Israel, the law, with respect to, primarily with respect to who God is and what he values. And in that sense, I think we can extrapolate to, that would be true of the Bible in general, both the Old and the New Testament, that all of those writings are extremely helpful information in helping us to reconstruct in our own minds who God is and what he values, a picture of God. So that's the sense in which I think that's what we are to meditate on, and I think that is what is helpful. Now, the gospel is also a part of that, in the sense of God's provision for us. And that's part of the picture as well, that it's not just that God demands obedience from us and that God is just a rule maker. The picture is much more complete than that. It's fuller than that. God is one ultimately who is in charge of our salvation. He's the one who brings us along. And that's all a part of that bigger portrait that we need to understand and incorporate into our thinking. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
When you were talking about this, I wondered, Jericho was a very, very old city.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read archaeologists, it was a very old city, and that was a major trade city.
Mm-hmm.
So I think probably news of the from Egypt was a major civilization and so on. So I'm thinking there were a lot of foreigners in Jericho.
That's probably true.
Yeah, and I'm thinking maybe that Rahab was a foreigner.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think we have, I mean, it's possible, but we don't have really any evidence either way.
Yeah, I mean, after studying history, it makes me think that Rahab and her family were probably foreigners and maybe had some ties to the Israelites or something, because if I understand correctly, what we term as Israelites weren't just descendants of Abraham, that there were some other foreigners and so with the Israelites. And so I think that it was probably many of the foreigners with the Israelites, and that probably had some maybe connections with Rahab, with the foreigners, or with the Israelites.
Well, it is true that there are people who are not genetically related to Abraham who become part of the people of Israel. There are indications that there were some Egyptians that joined them when they came out of Egypt, and then we'll have Rahab join them here, and there are a few others from Canaan who become part of the people of Israel. So it is true that there are some non-Israelites that become a part of Israel. That's true. Whether Rahab has some kind of distant ties to the people of Israel, I don't know that we have any way of knowing that one way or another. There probably were foreigners in Jericho. Could she be non-Canaanite? Well, even the term Canaanite is a pretty comprehensive term that includes a lot of people who are not all ethnically related. Canaan is a land that where trade is one of the major parts of the economy.
Yeah, I understand.
And it is a crossroads, as you said, of people going from Egypt to Mesopotamia, and those are the two major civilizations of the world at the time. So there are a lot of people going through there. That's absolutely right.
Yeah, well, I understand it. That was kind of like a Corinthian was a major city,
mm-hmm.
and I think Jericho was like Corinthian with, you know, many different religions, many foreigners, a big cosmopolitan trade center. I mean, if we think about today, like Amsterdam, I mean, there's foreigners everywhere. And you also see a lot of the religions and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And just one more thing, I think about Balaam. Maybe he was related to maybe Jericho and so on, because he said he got a sense from like a spiritual being or something. And, you know, I think probably there's a major connection between Egypt, Jericho, and Balaam, and so on.
It's possible. I don't know what indications there are that would make that more likely, but mm-hmm. certainly possible.
Okay. Thank you.
You don't have to answer this now. Maybe as time progresses, if you can deal with the whole issue, the ethics and the morality of this group of people being told to go in and wipe out all different other ethnic groups, and
mm-hmm.
it's just a whole interesting concept to deal with.
Okay. I will put that off.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.